Web Development with .NET 6 with Daniel Roth.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host, for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and running your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything the .NET ecosystem has to offer. And lots of people and myself are doing tons of online user group speaking. So if you run a .NET or Azure-related user group, I'd love to give a presentation for you. Just reach out. And our sponsor is ClearMeasure, and they make this software happen. We're a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. So if we can help, please get in touch. And if you're a .NET software engineer who wants a path to become an architect, we're hiring, and I'd love to work with you. You can go to clearmeasure.com/careers. And before leaving that topic, I wanted to put out a call for a special role. I'm hiring another apprentice for myself. I hired an apprentice last year, and he's grown so fast that he's already been promoted, and I'm coaching him through his next phase. But the apprentice that I'm looking for should be either straight out of schooling, whatever level that is, any level is fine. And if you or anyone you know loves to code and is convinced that being a professional software engineer is your career path, then please apply. And my apprentice is going to work hand in hand with me in R&D, blazing the trail, cutting patterns and templates and guidance for developing and running applications with the latest in .NET and Azure. And then finally, be sure to check out the new video show, Architect Tips. And now let's get on with our guest for today. We have Daniel Roth, and he is a program manager on the ASP.NET team, working on ASP.NET Core, Blazor, and other features. Daniel, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
Very good. It's good to be here again, Jeff.
Absolutely. For the listeners, you were on the show on episode 47 over 2 years ago, talking about things that were new then, but a lot has changed since then in the .NET world.
Yeah, no, the things have moved along very fast. I mean, .NET 5 has shipped since then. The core, the name core is gone from .NET. It's the next version of .NET is really .NET Core. So .NET 5 shipped back in November, and we're already well on our way to finishing up .NET 6, actually, which should ship again this November. We're on that yearly cadence, so we're getting a new major release of .NET every year. And yeah, lots of exciting stuff is in the works.
And on that note, I think is it being officially released at the .NET Conf, or that's a really big annual thing. I think I read some blog posts that there's some already public announcements for .NET Conf, but for people who don't know about .NET Conf, do you have a part to play in that?
Absolutely. So .NET Conf is a yearly online event that we've been doing for a while now. It's my favorite conference, like my favorite developer conference by far. I'm not biased at all, but yeah, this is my favorite conference. It's like 72 hours straight, I think we've done in the past. I can't remember if we're going that long this year, of just sessions and content about .NET. It's a combination of people from the product team and people from the community talking about projects that they're working on. And yes, we will be releasing .NET 6 this November at .NET Conf. So make sure you mark your calendars and tune in and join us. You can ask questions live and get your questions answered live. And that's what we'll be talking about, all the new features coming in .NET 6.
November 9th. Yeah, mark the calendars. And I know it's your favorite, because it's virtual and you get to do it in your pajamas.
That's right.
Now, y'all have a pretty decent studio set up for it now.
And now I think we might actually be able to go into the studio to record things, like with the COVID restrictions for many of the conferences, couldn't even go into the studio. We were doing a lot of those things from home. And so everyone's been scrambling to get, nicer mics and cameras, trying to be able to do decent live streams from our homes. Very convenient, but there is something really cool about being able to go into the studio and be in front of the camera and talk to the .NET community. Yeah. I think we're doing that this year. Some of them, it might be a mix, like some from the studio and some from people's homes.
Yeah. Well, and the teams are so just geographically distributed. There's only a studio in one place.
Not everyone can fly from, you know, Europe to Seattle in order to come to the,
that's right,
come to the studio. That's right.
Well, we've had Scott Hunter and some other folks, Amanda Silver, talking about kind of what the things coming up in .NET 6 and whatnot. But your focus is on the web technologies, and you go deep in there. You dream in Blazor these days, I imagine.
So Blazor is my focus, and it has been a lot of fun. We shipped Blazor WebAssembly and Blazor Server in .NET 5, so the, you know, fully supported release. Lots of great new functionality that came out with .NET 5, like support for virtualization and pre-rendering, a whole bunch of cool things. And right now, Blazor is one of the fastest growing workloads in .NET in terms of adoption of new people trying out the stack. Lots of people jumping on the Blazor train, which is super fun. And .NET 6, we have even more goodies that are coming in Blazor, but also lots of improvements to ASP.NET Core and lots of broad platform improvements to .NET itself in .NET 6.
One of the things that I think, what was it, mid-August, preview 7 of .NET 6 with a bunch of Blazor enhancements, I think that came out. So it looks like once a month that there's a preview coming out, at least for the last few months. Do you expect for there to be some more previews before GA, or is this preview 7 kind of one of the end?
Preview 7 was the last sort of feature preview. We're now moving into building the actual release candidate for the final release in November. So here in not too long, in September, there should be an initial release candidate for the November release. There will also be a second sort of follow-on release candidate in October, addressing any feedback that we get from the September release candidate. And then the plan is to ship it in November. We are schedule driven. So we expect to ship a major .NET release, like I said, every year. The even numbered releases are long-term support releases. So .NET 6 has a long-term support contract. It means it'll be supported for at least 3 years. The odd number releases we call current releases. And those are for people that just want to always ride on the latest. They always want the latest features, and they're willing to move to the next release relatively quickly. .NET 5 support lifecycle, I think, actually ends only like 3 or 3 to 6 months after .NET 6 actually ships. So people that jumped on .NET 5 will want to jump to .NET 6 relatively quickly. .NET 6 is for the even number releases are for customers that prefer something a little bit slower moving. They can, you know, stay in a platform, get some value out of it for a while, and then move on to the next one when it comes out in a couple of years down the road. So they're not always churning underneath them. That said, the release is a highly compatible release, so you should be able to take an existing .NET 5 application, upgrade it, or even honestly .NET Core 3.1, which was our previous long-term support release. You should be able to take apps that were built against those target frameworks and update them to .NET 6 relatively seamlessly.
Well, I was going on to your blog and the dev blogs just earlier today, looking at the preview 7 and the new things that are in there, and then the pop-up, and I'm the marketing department probably puts these pop-ups for a Razor Pages video or Razor Pages tutorial, and so can you talk a little bit about the strategy? Is Blazor kind of like the new normal web application going forward, or is there a hey, this for the rich stuff, and then is Razor Pages the just, you know, informational document style prime? What is the whole strategy? There's a whole bunch of stuff that you can do, but you know, for the next 10 years, is there like a prediction for, you know what, this is going to be the normal .NET project type for the web?
Oh, I love this question. Yes, this is a great question, because I talk to customers and developers all the time that are a little bit confused about this sometimes. So hopefully we can clear some of that up right now. So the way we think about this on the team is, well, ASP.NET and ASP.NET Core have always had support for building web apps. And the way we did that is we took your .NET code and we ran it on the server. And then the web UI was what I call server rendered. Like you ran some .NET code and it generated HTML, which then got sent down to the browser and then rendered in the browser. All the smarts for generating that UI were on the server. If you want to do anything that involved client-side interactivity, you know, running code on the user's machine in their browser with their CPU and their memory, well, you would write JavaScript. That was the only option. You had to write some JavaScript in order to do that. And many customers still do that with ASP.NET Core and by using popular JavaScript frameworks like Angular and React and pairing those with an ASP.NET Core, like a web API backend. Still very, very common. What Blazor did, where Blazor fits in that picture is, well, what if I don't really want to write JavaScript? What if JavaScript's not my forte? I'm a .NET dev. That's where my skills are. Is there a way that I could, you know, build that full stack web application without having to work with JavaScript and deal with another set of skills, tool chain, language, ecosystem? Can I do it with .NET? And that's the hole, the gap in the .NET platform that Blazor fills. It's for client-side UI, highly interactive client-side logic where you want it to run on the user's machine. Now, Blazor doesn't replace all the cases where it's still perfectly valid to render the HTML from the server. Like you might, we actually use Blazor and the server render technologies like Razor Pages or MVC. Razor Pages really is just MVC, by the way. It's just sort of a facade on top of it. It's all the same infrastructure under the covers. All Razor Pages did was give you a page-based programming model for dynamically generating HTML and web UI from the server. Under the covers is all really MVC. But the idea is you can use these things together. Like in Blazor, maybe you want to render some HTML initially. Like you've got all the data on the server, you're right there, you just do the database query, you render a bunch of HTML down to the browser. But in the background, then you wire up the app for interactivity and client-side UI. So you set up Blazor after that initial render. The initial render is server-side rendering. You'd use a Razor page for that, or you could use an MVC view. For the client-side interactivity, you use Blazor. So they're meant to be complementary. If you're doing stuff from the server, then you've got Razor pages and MVC, which are really the same thing. If you're doing client-side UI, then that's what Blazor is for. It's an alternative to having to write all of your client-side UI logic in JavaScript. Now, there's a whole debate about should every app be a single page app, a spa style application? Should every app only be JavaScript and not do any of that server rendered stuff? Our belief is that no, there are lots of apps actually that are much better suited to leveraging the power of the server for rendering that UI. If you've ever been to a website and had to sit there through loading spinners that are probably, downloading JavaScript bundles and trying to execute all that client side when they could have just given you the data right away, then you kind of know what I mean. Like those apps maybe probably would have been better with a server render technology for that particular scenario. So these are complementary web UI technologies that are all part of ASP.NET Core, which is the complete package. Like it has everything you need for building web apps, from web UI to backend services like HP services, gRPC, SignalR, and so forth.
So I'm guessing that blog sites are not a good candidate for Blazor?
Probably not, right? You got the blog data, you could just render the HTML and you're good. But there may be parts that it makes sense to use Blazor for. Like if you have a blog with commenting, maybe that commenting is more of an interactive UI. And so you actually want a Blazor component down at the bottom of your blog page that handles the commenting system. One of the beautiful things about having Blazor and Razor Pages and MVC all be part of the same cohesive UI framework is that they're built to use together. You can take a Blazor component and just throw it into a Razor page or throw it into an MVC view and render it there. And that just works. Like that type of integration is absolutely intended and supported out of the box. The thing I just hope people realize is that even though right now, Blazor's fairly, it's not as new as it was. It's been around for a few years now, but it's a newer part of the stack. So there's more features that come to Blazor than say a mature technology like Razor Pages. That should not be interpreted as a signal that you need to go take all your MVC code or Razor Pages code and rewrite it all as Blazor. That's not the intent. Blazor should accrue value to your existing apps, not replace.
So how does that work? That's really intriguing. You can have a MVC or Razor Pages site and then say, okay, I want a section to be Blazor. Now, what is it, just a Blazor component, or do you also set up a Blazor layout? Is it a special control? How does that work?
So So we ship a component tag helper. So, you know, in Razor Pages and MVC, we have tag helpers, which are little pieces of server-side code that can participate in the rendering logic of the page. The component tag helper, its job is it knows how to render a Blazor component, and it can do it in a couple of different ways. The most naive thing it can do is you can just take the Blazor component, render it from the server into the page so that you just get the HTML in line. That's the pre-rendered version of the component. It can do it paired with also client-side interactivity, either with the Blazor server pattern, the hosting model, or the Blazor WebAssembly hosting model. So in addition to pre-rendering the content, or maybe you decide you don't want to pre-render that content and you only want the client-side interactivity, it will also put like a marker onto the page so that when you get the page in the browser also, you set up the corresponding JavaScript framework file like blazor.server.js or blazor.webassembly.js. When that client-side logic framework piece boots up, it will then render the correct component into that part of the page by manipulating the DOM from the browser. If it's a Blazor server app, it's going to be setting up a SignalR connection and getting a DOM diff from the server that it then shoves into the DOM right there. If it's a Blazor WebAssembly app, you'll be booting up DLLs and your components right there on the browser and then having them tell you tell the system what part of the DOM to update based on what the components render. So that's how it's done. The main user interface piece is the component tag helper. That's how you say where in your views or pages do you want a component.
That's really cool. That's really I wasn't aware of that, and I think a lot of listeners will be interested because there's so many applications where you're right. You can tell it's either React or Angular or Vue because you go to the search engine and click it, and now it's loading. Whereas you go to a good old, prehistoric active server pages or a WordPress site, and then boom, it's done. It's all, you can see it immediately.
Yeah, so with ASP.NET Core, you get the best. You can get the best of both. In fact, Blazor server apps by default are already set up this way. Like they're set up to pre-render because you're going to run the components server side anyway. So why not go ahead and pre-render them? So they pre-render initially, and then the WebSocket connection gets set up. And then the components are used for any interactivity. And it happens very, very quick. So you see the page almost instantaneously, and then you get interactivity very shortly thereafter. Very similar with Blazor WebAssembly. We don't put this in the templates by default, but you can absolutely set it up where you pre-render the component from the server and then set it up for interactivity on the client. The reason why we don't set it up by default is because it does now force you to remember that your component might run on either side of the wire. Like on the pre-rendering, it's going to be on the server. And so, you might be able to like just call the database from there. But when it gets downloaded to the client, now you're in the browser. So you can't just randomly connect to the database or do other things that browsers can't do. So you're forced to remember that, which adds a little bit more complexity than we thought we'd impose on people by default. But when you do wire it up, if you do get into that mental model and in that mode, then your Blazor WebAssembly app, you know, loads almost instantaneously because it gets the batch of HTML from the server, and then you get the interactivity soon thereafter. It kind of mitigates the load time delay of having to download, you know, a WebAssembly.NET runtime with your app.
Yeah, I'm thinking of all the cases where previously, maybe you had the old school snippet of jQuery or Ajax or JavaScript control or something in one little spot. And now, I've met so many JavaScript developers, and so many of those don't actually like programming in JavaScript. And so some of them go to TypeScript, some of them just do it and complain about it. But yeah, if we can do it in C#, so much better. Now, speaking of Blazor, on the WebAssembly side, I think .NET 6 is, at least I'm looking at .NET 6 for the one where it's like, okay, now I don't have to do some the workarounds for WebAssembly, whether it's, you know, debugger or whatnot. How streamlined and seamless is the WebAssembly experience going to be in .NET 6 now?
So the .NET 6 WebAssembly support is significantly more feature rich than what we had in .NET 5. I mean, .NET 5 was a fully supported Blazor WebAssembly release, and you can write all sorts of apps with what was shipped in that release. One of the limitations with Blazor WebAssembly support in .NET 5 was that the runtime itself is an IL interpreter at the end of the day. It's you download .NET assemblies into the browser, and then you, along with it, you download a chunk of WebAssembly, which is an implementation of a .NET runtime. It's just a very simple runtime that knows how to interpret .NET IL. Now, that works fine for a whole bunch of applications, but it's not the fastest thing in the world for runtime execution. Like if you're trying to do something really CPU intensive, like image processing or like Monte Carlo simulations or whatever, that IL interpreter is gonna drag compared to what you would expect from a normal JIT-based .NET runtime that's like, you know, jitting things to native instructions on the fly. It's just unfortunate that with WebAssembly, there's no real JIT capability in the standard yet. You know, maybe at some future point that will be enabled, but that's not really something you can do right now. So in .NET 6, in order to enable scenarios that require more runtime performance, we're enabling support for ahead of time compilation for WebAssembly. What that means is you can take your .NET code and sort of pre-compile it to WebAssembly from, as part of the publish step of your application. You instead of downloading just DLLs, you're now downloading a larger WebAssembly bundle that includes the runtime pieces and your code, and it runs much, much faster. Like demos that we've done where you show like basic image editing gestures, they run like 10 times faster with a ahead of time compiled application. Now, there are some trade-offs with this model that are worth calling out. With ahead of time compilation, you're taking .NET IL instructions and turning them into what's sort of the native instructions of the web, right? You're turning them into WebAssembly instructions. And the IL instructions are actually fairly high level. So in order to convert them into that to WebAssembly, they tend to be more code. So it gets bigger. So ahead of time compiled Blazor WebAssembly app roughly is going to be about twice as large to in terms of download transfer size than its interpreted equivalent in .NET 5. But the benefit is you get way better runtime performance. So you're trading off load time a little bit, like with a larger download versus better runtime performance. You know, whether that will make sense for your particular application will depend on your scenarios. But for a bunch of scenarios, that trade-off is perfectly fine because you're on like an internet with a huge pipe, yeah, and you don't really care if it's like 2 megabytes instead of one. That said, we do know that download size does matter. Load time does matter. So we're also doing a bunch of work in .NET 6 to shrink the default size of a Blazor WebAssembly app. So the starting point of your app is actually going to be smaller in .NET 6 than it was in .NET 5. And we've done that through a number of really, really clever things. First of all, the IL trimmer, the thing that goes through your .NET code and figures out what code you don't really need and just strips it out.
The tree shaker?
Yeah, the tree shaker is equivalent to the tree shaker, is much smarter in .NET 6. We've done a lot of work on the core framework libraries to make them more linkable. The linker itself is more intelligent. So we can pull out more .NET code that you don't need. In .NET 5, the WebAssembly bundle that came with your app was a fixed cost. Like that was the runtime and you always got it and there was nothing you could do about it. In .NET 6, with the same tool chain that we use for ahead of time compilation, we can now actually link the WebAssembly part. Like if you have parts of the runtime that your app isn't using, then we can just strip that out. An example is like a lot of the globalization features. You know, a big part of that WebAssembly bundle is a bunch of logic for dealing with globalization concerns. If you decide to publish your app using invariant globalization, then you don't need any of that stuff. And so you can yank all that stuff out of the runtime and have a much smaller bundle. So a default, I think like a minimum Blazor WebAssembly app in .NET 5 was like 1.6, 1.7 megabytes transferred. If you like trimmed it down to like, you know, took all the code and linked it as much as it could be. In .NET 6 right now, we can produce just over a meg, like 1.1 megs about the size of a minimum Blazor WebAssembly app in .NET 6. So that's nice. Even though if you decide to AOT, it will get bigger. Well, at least your starting point is smaller. And if you're doing interpreted, then your app definitely will be smaller than it was in .NET 5.
Yeah, it's a third smaller or around there.
About 35% smaller, I think, was when I had a calculator up. I'm not going to do the mental math. I think it was about that much smaller, which is great.
What's the WebAssembly debugging experience for .NET 6? Is it any different, or what are the steps
So the debugging experience during dev is way better. The you know, debugging a Blazor WebAssembly app is a bit of magic. Like it's pretty tricky what we do there in order to enable a .NET debugging experience. Because remember, your .NET code is running on top of a WebAssembly runtime inside of a browser. So how do you even talk to that thing? How do you set up debugging? The way we do it is actually done through the JavaScript debugger. We speak the JavaScript debugging protocol from the browsers, and we augment that protocol with .NET specific concepts using a little debug proxy that ships with the SDK. So when you're debugging from Visual Studio, Blazor WebAssembly app, and you hit F5, we fire up that debug proxy. Visual Studio acts like a JavaScript debugging client. Like it acts like the browser dev tools effectively. It talks to our debugging proxy, which then talks to the browser in order to make all the right mappings and things happen. So you can debug not only your .NET code, but any also JavaScript code that you might have. Like if you're doing JavaScript interop calls, you can even step through into the JavaScript code as well. That whole system has gotten much more reliable in .NET 6 with Visual Studio 2022. A lot more features from the debugger have been lit up. Things that you would expect the .NET debugger to be able to do, like display name attributes and so forth. A lot of those things now work as you would expect with Blazor WebAssembly debugging. It's much more on par with the .NET debugging experience.
So is it a true statement that in VS 2022, Blazor WebAssembly, the debugger, quote, just works?
Yes. If it doesn't, then that's let awesome. Me know.
Well, I remember this dev. Oh, wait, no. Here's the command line to start up the browser with this command line switch so that you've got, you know,
various things. I mean, even with .NET 5 and like VS 2019, you should be able to file a new project, create a new Blazor WebAssembly app with .NET 5, hit F5 and hit a breakpoint in your counter or hit the breakpoints in your uninitialized async methods, like in the fetch data page, like all that stuff worked even with .NET 5 and VS 2019. There's just things that are a little bit more polished in .NET 6. Like there were some cases in .NET 5 where there were some timing issues where before the debugger had really had a chance to hook itself in, the code with the breakpoint might have already run in some cases. Like if you had a breakpoint really early on in the app lifecycle, we've done things now so that we delay things correctly so that those breakpoints will correctly get hit. That type of polish is really the things that I hope that you'll see in Visual Studio 2022 with .NET 6.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
One of the things that people have struggled with is how to have a little tiny database in WebAssembly on the client side. And you guys have done some work there as well, right?
Yeah, so this is new. This is coming out. I don't think we didn't, technically it's actually in .NET 6 Preview 7, although we didn't really talk about it yet because there were a few new additional improvements to the feature that we wanted to do. But in .NET 6, we are adding support for linking in native dependencies into your Blazor WebAssembly applications. So for example, let's say you want to use SQLite as a database and you want to use it client side on the user's machine in the browser. You'll be able to link in SQLite as a native dependency into the Blazor WebAssembly app and then just use it from the web platform, or a library like a drawing library like Skia. You can link that in and do drawing gestures client side from the browser. This is again, all using the same .NET WebAssembly build tool chain that we're using for ahead of time compilation. We're using it for runtime relinking. It's a tool chain based on Emscripten. So we are using Emscripten under the covers, if you're familiar with that that SDK. Emscripten is a tool chain that allows you to take code and produce WebAssembly. And that you can do that with including like C and C++ code, native code, in order to produce WebAssembly. And we're leveraging that tool chain in order to enable all these scenarios: ahead of time compilation, runtime relinking, and also support for native dependencies coming soon.
Nice. Oh, I can see so many use cases for that. Now, Blazor is, I mean, tons of stuff with Blazor, but what else caught my eye, and of course, I've been doing .NET since it came out, and so I could take a lot of it for granted, but I always looked at the new, the file new project templates, and there was just a lot of code there, and there's been a lot of work with minimal APIs and just making less code. Talk about the strategy behind it. We can get into the details, but talk about what the thinking is about what why it's important.
Yeah, no, I love the new ASP.NET Core experience in .NET 6. It is just so clean now and simple. So the if you've programmed with ASP.NET Core before, ASP.NET Core was rebuilt from the ground up to be a high performance web framework. So it has a completely new hosting model and new servers. We got Kestrel, a new web server. It's got a new middleware model and specific patterns for how you set that all up. Like there was usually you have a startup class, and in that class you have two methods that are kind of special, like configure services and configure. Configure services is where you put the services you want to be available through dependency injection. Dependency injection is built in ASP.NET Core. And configure is where you set up that middleware pipeline, the things that you want to happen with each request as requests come into your system. And it's all great. It's very composable. It's very flexible, very high performance. You can get down to just bare metal performance with ASP.NET Core and on some of the public benchmarks for comparing web frameworks across the developer ecosystem. ASP.NET Core is right there at the top in terms of runtime throughput performance and memory usage and so forth. But I mean, there's a bit of ceremony in setting up an ASP.NET Core app. Like you need, a bunch of files. Like you got to have that startup class. You have your program CS file that actually sets up the host. You have, if you're building endpoints, then you have controller classes for actually, receiving requests and generating some JSON and so forth. When we looked at that and compare it to some of the other offerings in the developer ecosystem, for a new developer, it's a bit much. Like, do they really need to be exposed to all these concepts? Can we give you a smoother on-ramp to getting started with ASP.NET Core that doesn't require quite as many machinations? And that's where this idea of minimal APIs and the new minimal hosting model in .NET 6 came from. You can create an ASP.NET Core app, and this is literally true. You can create a full ASP.NET Core app with three lines of code. Like it's literally three lines long and have a working endpoint that returns you some JSON or some data. That is all you need. And this is possible due to a whole variety of investments and improvements that have been done up and down the stack. We've been working very closely with our friends on the C# team and updating all the ASP.NET Core templates to use the latest, greatest C# features and idioms and modern patterns. So we've updated all the ASP.NET Core templates now to use top-level statements in the program CS files. That removes the need to explicitly say that I have a program class and it has a main function. And I know some people, this was hard. This was like, wait a minute, we're going to take away my program. Just think of it as it's still there. We're just not requiring you to type it. Like you don't have to have it there anymore because it's kind of implied. That's what top level statements are. So if you look at a program CS file in .NET 6 and you've been used to seeing program main, you might be like, oh, wait a minute, is this still C#? Yes, it is. It is modern C# is the way to think about it. So that's one. Like global using statements, where you can define using statements that kind of just get applied throughout the project, so you don't have to have them in every single file. And we implicitly add some using statements for you so that you don't have to remember, oh, I need using ASP.NET Core, using directives, not statements, using directives.
Well, that's important. With the global usings per project, that using block at the top of every code file, That says what could be, eight lines of code pretty much in every 4 to 8 lines of code in every file. Did y'all go
just less noise.
What about namespaces? How far did you go to make like class definitions? Do we infer namespaces based on folder structure, or is that still required?
When we generate code, we do that. But for code that's just a normal C# file, we're now leveraging the new file scoped namespaces feature, where you can just in a single line say, like, the namespace for this file is this namespace, and you don't have to have things nested inside of an additional layer of curly braces. So yeah, we're using nullability, like the nullability checking features that were added to C# to, you know, to prevent the worst, the most costly issue in all of computer programming, which is a null reference exception. All of the HTML core templates now have the nullability checking turned on by default. So you get those benefits from the compiler as well. So we did all of that. And then on top of that, on top of leveraging modern C#, we also improved the APIs. So we have a new hosting API for setting up the server and configuring the middleware that is just really trivial to use. You just create a web application. You add, it has a services property right on it. You add services to it. If you've been doing Blazor development for a little while and you're familiar with how the Blazor WebAssembly host gets set up in ProgramCS, then this will look actually kind of familiar because it's a very similar pattern. So it's just one file, create your host, add the services, build the app, and then add your middleware. Routing is much more first class in this model. So you can very easily route to code from that single file. And all the patterns, there's a whole bunch of new patterns that we've enabled for those route handlers. So you can just say, like, I want to map a get action. You know, I want to have an endpoint that responds to get requests. Here's the route, give you a string. And then here's a delegate. Here's a Lambda. Nice. And maybe it returns an object. If it returns an object, we'll automatically serialize it as JSON. If it returns some string, you'll get some text content. It automatically binds input parameters, just like you would expect, you know, bind input JSON if it's a post. You can bind from query string parameters and route values very, very naturally. So it's just a very simple way to set up endpoints and to get going with ASP.NET Core, way simpler than ever before. None of the old stuff is gone. Like if you want to build controllers and you like the old web hosting model, and you like startup classes, it's all still there. It's not going away. You can absolutely continue to use that. And maybe in some cases that actually makes more sense for the size of your application, the things that you're doing. But for a lot of apps, we think this is a much more comfortable on-ramp to getting started with ASP.NET Core.
Oh yeah. I've volunteered with my high school's, the local high school's computer science department. I looked at it and thought, man, there's so much ceremony. How would these high school students, that's why they choose, you know, PHP and, you know, Python on the, it's because there's just less stuff to get, you know, some simple code working. So this is cool.
Some people have called, some people have seen it, have noticed some similarities to Express.js. So if you've operated at all in the Node community and you're familiar with Express, then some of this stuff will be like, oh, okay, I kind of see what this is. This is kind of like that, but in C# and .NET with strongly typed idioms and so forth. If you come from that world, this will also feel fairly familiar.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it actually reminds me of the web technology that preceded active server pages, the IDC and HTX templates that were in IIS2.
Oh, and
the IDC file, the Internet Database Connector file, was just a little bit of procedural code. You just call your database and you run your if statement, and then the information got just passed straight into the HTX template, which is effectively HTML with the server code nuggets. Yeah, ASP.NET was the second technology to use the @ for the code nuggets.
Were things simpler back then, Jeff? Was it just easier?
You know what? In a lot of ways, well, the expectations of the customer were a lot less. Let's put it that way.
Your app's got to do a lot more. Yeah, I mean, I feel that I really relate to that statement because it does seem like the demands of software development just keep getting broader and more richer. Yeah, you're asked to do a lot more with a lot less with software these days, and that can be tricky. And our job as framework authors is trying to help you out with that.
Trying to
so that things just work and handle the scenarios that you really care about.
Yeah, well, it used to be magic, you know, what programmers did, and now it's the statements are, you're not done yet. It's just a website. Come on.
Right. A website that has to work on desktop and mobile and has to be globalized and has to be accessible and, you know, all these things. Yeah. Yeah. Secure, by the way, right. Secure too.
Oh, details. Cool.
I forgot to mention the performance also for the minimal APIs model. Like one of the really nice things about minimal APIs is because they sit so close to the middleware stack. Like you're basically just routing to code. Their performance is phenomenal. Like it's very close to being on par with just raw middleware performance. So that's another benefit of that model. Not only is it simpler, but you're going to get substantially better throughput.
Well, that's a good point. And I've looked at the chart of performance stats. I think I forgot the name of it, but I saw some frameworks that were labeled as faster than ASP.NET, but I didn't recognize the names. Is there any practical framework that anybody uses that we know about that is benchmarked to be faster than ASP.NET at this point?
No.
Okay.
There's some interesting frameworks in the Rust community that I think are coming out that are doing well. I think one of them, I forget the name of it, but I think one of them actually came from someone at Microsoft that was playing around with Rust. There's probably some in the Java space. Also, Java's very active in doing experimental things. But yeah, for the most part, I think the benchmarks we typically use are called TechEmpower, and they're a set of open source benchmarks that compare any and all web frameworks against a common set of scenarios. And ASP.NET Core does really, really well. Like in the composite benchmarks, we're in the top 10. I think we were at 8 last I checked. And if you look at the other options in that list, they're fairly esoteric. Like you start looking at C and C++ based frameworks that you've never heard of. And the ones that you have heard of, like if looking for Node or Ruby or like, some of the more common enterprise Java patterns, like they're pretty far down the stack. We take performance in ASP.NET Core very seriously. Like it's part of our culture. Like every release, performance is always a goal. .NET 6 is the fastest, most performant ASP.NET Core and .NET framework we've ever shipped. And I got to say that in .NET 5, and it's true again, because we're always investing in that space. And we have the luxury of being able to do the tuning at any layer of the stack. We can do it in the compiler. We can do it in the runtime. We can do it in the frameworks. Like we fiddle around all over the place to get as much performance out of the stack as possible, so your costs are as low as possible.
Yeah, and it's a good time to be a .NET developer. I keep reminding people, because it wasn't amplified like I thought it would. Just this past, this past January, or maybe it was even December or November, Azure came out with the V3 app service instances that are twice as powerful for half the cost, but you have to redeploy your apps to get from V2 to V3. And so I'll just say that again for anybody who hasn't heard that. You can be running at half the cost, twice the power, just by redeploying your app in Azure.
Nice. That's cool.
Well, exactly. It's like, why hasn't this been shouted from the rooftops? Well, we had Stefan Chekow on the show, and he was talking about the V3 app service instances and all the other details, and that was one of the big announcements. So yeah, it's a good time to be a .NET developer for sure.
You know, it's not just about runtime performance. Like we also care deeply, particularly in .NET 6, about developer velocity, like your productivity with the framework. We're doing a lot of work in Visual Studio 2022 and with tooling to make it so that you can build your apps faster, see the changes from your code changes faster. One of the great new features in .NET 6 is support for .NET Hot Reload, where as you're editing your code, we will calculate the IL diff of exactly that what the code needs to change in the runtime, and we'll blit it into the runtime while the app is running, so that you don't have to go through the whole shut down the app, rebuild it, get it started again in order to see those changes. If you're deep in like a particular part of your app, like you're in like a tree view and you're looking at a particular part of that that UI, and you just want to fiddle with one thing and you don't want to have to re-navigate to get there again, .NET Hot Reload will preserve the state of the app while you're making changes. So you get this ultra fast, like it's actually surprising how quick these hot reloaded changes can be applied. Ultra fast developer inner loop while also getting the benefit of app state preservation while you're making those changes. So that's also coming in .NET 6. Definitely check that out with VS 2022.
Nice. Yeah, lots of stuff. Well, Daniel, thanks for coming on the show and giving us the rundown. It's a lot of great stuff, a lot of things to be excited about.
No problem. And, there's plenty more. I mean, you should definitely go check out the release notes, join us at .NET Conf, and we'll talk about all the things that are coming for web development, mobile development, desktop development. It's going to be an epic release.
Nice. Well, I look forward to it for sure. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.